Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Stephen Hooper to Your Health. Welcome, Stephen.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You know, we're going to have a great conversation today. We'll be talking with Dr. Antoine Ballard, one of your faculty members and a professor in the University of North Carolina's Allied Health Division of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy, about the big impact tiny changes can have on mental illness and homelessness.
Right. And Dr. Ballard is one of the few researchers in occupational science and actually crosses over into mental health, which is a long history of the field of occupational therapy, but few practitioners these days. So he's one of a sort of a new renaissance.
Before we get to his conversation, we're going to have some conversation about some important research that matters, some of which actually is important to mental and physical health. Let's dive right into our very first research about exercise and health, but this is about the father exercising and the children's health.
Typically, we hear about the importance of the mother exercising, but the father?
This is interesting because it's really looking at how this exercise, perhaps from the father, could impact, probably through healthier sperm, the conception and the ultimate metabolic health of the children. And this was research published in the journal Diabetes.
It actually created what we would call epigenetic changes in the sperm, meaning that the environmental effects had an impact on the sperm. And the fact of the matter is that the babies ended up being healthier.
Now, this was done in mice, but they fed these mice either a normal diet or a high-fat diet for 3 weeks. And looking then at the offspring and their body weight, their fat mass, how they metabolize blood sugars, and those who had the high-fat diet did bad, as we might expect, and developed diabetes more frequently. But those that exercised did not have that effect. And when the dad exercised, even the high-fat diet, their children didn't have that effect. So it translated, as you said, in the change in perhaps the RNA, the kind of the building blocks of the DNA and there and how it's expressed. A fascinating research.
And it parallels findings in mothers who exercise. And you wonder if both of them together create a more synergistic effect for the offspring. So we'll see if that translates to humans.
Well, we know this next research translates to humans because it was done in humans. And this is actually something that's really critically important to what's happening in society today, how results of presidential elections affect health. And boy, this is a loaded topic.
Yeah, the last election created enormous distress. And just anecdotally, I'm sure you've heard, Adam, that there were lots of families that were arguing at the dinner table about this one, and the amount of stress was probably enormous afterwards.
And, you know, it's interesting because it may be presumed, well, if you were supporting a particular candidate, then you were more or less happier with that candidate. And if you weren't supportive, then you were unhappy. What I wonder, and that's what this research is going to show. let's just kind of get the punchline. But what I don't know is, has this been like this forever? So in this particular study among 769 college students followed after the election, they were looking at whether or not there were depressive symptoms, avoidance of certain people and situations and intrusions associated with the stress.
Correct. And a population was college students, a rather large sample of about 769. And the finding was is that a quarter of those students, 25%, reported clinically significant stress symptoms related to the election. So what do they do about that? In many ways, you sit there and you say, well, do these students need some help for those symptoms in one side of the equation? And the other side is, wow, what a number.
Yeah. And whether that translates into anger and frustration and depression. It turns out this was found higher in sexual minorities and African Americans, perhaps not surprising given what's happening in the country. And there was less stress by registered Republicans in males. Even 25% said that the election had a negative impact on relationships. Regardless, this is so concerning. And I think as a healthcare provider, the willingness to, when you know people are at risk, who may be at risk, you have to ask the question and be willing to listen and maybe refer for therapy if needed.
Additionally, I would add, it also impacts and suggests the importance of that college-age population in the voting world. Because it does have an impact.
Hear. Our next research that matters, Steve, is about very young children and discrimination. We know that discrimination is such a pervasive aspect affecting minorities and women and lots of people in our society. And here's the question is, can you measure it and see it in children as young as 7?
This study would say, yes, you can. And in fact, they looked at 7-year-olds. When they looked at this issue of racial ethnic identity and how did it impact how the children saw themselves.
This research was published in the Journal of Cultural Diversity and Ethnic Minority Psychology, and they had 172 7-year children. Half were girls, half were boys. The majority were Latino, 19% were black, and the rest were multi-ethnic and racial. And they basically found that these kids reported with fairly reliable methods, you know, that they had been exposed to discrimination, but that those who had a stronger ethnic identity already formed by that age seemed to cope better.
Absolutely. And they also suggested that if, in fact, you did not have that sort of protective factor, if you will, there was an increase in internalizing symptoms such as anxiety and depression, as well as externalizing behaviors like oppositionality.
You know, we know that diversity in species is a good thing and that the less diversity we have as a species, the greater we lose. We also know in teams of people that diversity seems to bring talents from different people and it really improves the outcomes. Here, being able to identify with your own ethnic identity and have that strong sense is a type of diversity that seems to have a really protective effect. I really like this research. I think it's important. I think it opens up conversations that I'm willing to, again, listen.
I love that. You know, and we have television hosts that will say they're colorblind. And in fact, what this research would say is we don't want them to be colorblind. We want them to acknowledge and be proud of and recognize their racial identity. And sort of the other part of this that I really liked, Adam, was that there's something you can do about it.
Yeah.
So this is one where helping kids sort of through family, through community, through school to sort of recognize their racial diversity and the importance of that in sort of the team approach that you just mentioned a few moments ago.
Yeah. Let's talk about our last research that matters, Steve, and it's about walking and brain function.
Did you get your walk in today, Adam?
Well, I've been walking fast and I got a lot more to go. I don't have my brains functioning so well. But, you know, we're really talking about here, can just a simple amount of walking in a very mild pace actually improve memory? And can you actually measure that in the brain? That's kind of wild.
Yeah, they had 36 students that they invited in to a lab and basically had them do a pretty easy exercise, which was to sit on a stationary bike and just gradually pedal. They did not get their exercise up to a heightened amount where the heart was really beating. It was a casual glide on the bike.
Yeah, they say 30% of your maximum heart rate. They gave them these series of tasks afterwards, and it actually showed that it improved their memory. And then they actually repeated this exercise, and they did it with MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and they actually showed changes in the brain that are consistent with improved memory. This is a short experimental study, but boy, it's pretty cool.
It is really cool. And the fact is that not only did they show changes in the brain, but they showed changes in the brain where you would expect the brain activity to be from memory, an area called the hippocampus. So fascinating results. More to come on this one because I think if I could get by with 10 minutes on an easy exercise, I really need to do that.
And if that's what one can do, one should be really happy there are improvements in brain and lots of other areas. So That'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. Maybe we'll take a short walk. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Antoine Ballard, professor in the University of North Carolina's Allied Health Division of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy, about the big impact tiny changes can have on mental illness and homelessness. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Steve Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with Dr. Antoine Ballard, Associate Professor in the University of North Carolina's Allied Health Division of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy, about the big impact tiny changes can have on mental illness and homelessness. Welcome to Your Health.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it's great to have you here, not only because it's is it Allied Health Week?
Allied Health Week. That's
Allied
right.
Health Week, but really because the subject of your topics of research and interest are really, I think, fascinating to our listeners and to myself. But first, we'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in allied health, occupational therapy, and becoming a faculty member?
That's a great question. I certainly never thought I would be in my position right now. When I was an undergraduate, I never thought I'd be a professor. But I got into occupational therapy through my interest in autism. And Dr. Hooper, you may not know this, but I worked at a camp for adults and children with autism called Camp Oil in Moncure, North Carolina, and did that for several years in a row as a camp counselor and activity director. After graduating, I became a job coach for Division Teach, and I worked in the community with adults with autism and just supporting them in their everyday needs and being able to have jobs. And through that experience, I encountered occupational therapy because it's such a natural fit with that type of work. And it was just immediately motivating for me because of how practical and focused it is on everyday function. And I really appreciated the ability to make immediate changes with the people I was working with. And so once I got into occupational therapy school, which is a master's program, I fell in love with occupational science, which is more of the theoretical, research-based discipline that supports occupational therapy. And through that work, I started to realize that I had a lot of questions that needed to be answered. And through my clinical work, my field work, which is our training to become therapists, I also became very dissatisfied with the state of therapy. And so I became very motivated to make changes and to get involved in research and the theoretical work to support occupational therapy.
Great.
Antoine's one of my faculty members in Allied Health and one of our stars in occupational science.
Yeah, tell me, you know, as we think about occupational therapy, I think most of our listeners certainly understand physical therapy. They've been to see a physical therapist. They've had, you know, their shoulder injury, neck injury, hips, you know, on and on. A smaller minority would understand really occupational therapy. I know it because I injured and tore a small ligament in my hand, and it just wouldn't heal and it wouldn't heal. I kept bumping my hand, and it just kept pain. And finally, someone said, you need to see an occupational therapist who developed a customized splint for my hand, and it allowed something to heal up, which had been bothering me for 6 months to a year. It was such a small thing, but so important. Help us understand, what is it that occupational therapists do that's really important?
That's a really good question, and I'm really glad you asked it, because there's a lot of confusion over what occupational therapy can provide. And your experience with it is actually a very narrow slice of what we offer. What drew me to occupational therapy and what motivates me so much to continue this work is its focus on function and doing and what people can or can't do. And so our unit of intervention is function and occupation. That's what we call occupation. So it's a little deceiving, the term occupation, because people tend to think of work immediately. But a long time ago, that word actually meant something different. And it was much more of a meaningful activity that allowed you to grow and develop. And so this focus on function can translate to many different practice settings. And so we work in school systems, we work in mental health institutions, we work in the community, and we work with all sorts of folks who need any type of rehabilitation because of our focus on function again, functional independence, precisely.
Dr. Ballard, That leads into a question I have about, you know, we hear about sort of the little muscles that Adam was referring to and other areas that you just mentioned. But can you tell us a little bit about the link to mental health? Because when I think about mental health, I think about social workers and psychologists and counselors. I don't necessarily go to an occupational therapist or an occupational scientist. Can you help our listeners understand that linkage a bit more?
Another wonderful question. Thank you. So again, the focus on function or in mental health, we talk about it as living skills. And so if you are aware of adults with serious mental illness who are in the community, many of them have difficulty completing basic tasks of daily living, such as cooking or managing their money. And occupational therapists are trained to work on those types of living skills. We do have a unique approach in that in focusing on function, we don't focus on the person only, but we focus on how the person in the environment and the activity that they are performing come together to create function. And why that's so interesting is that shifts our intervention targets outside of the individual only, but we also intervene on how people are doing things, so the occupation in this case, and also the environment. We can structure the environment in such ways that facilitates function. So our we're looking at how those three things come together to create function.
So can you perhaps give an example of some recent work that you're doing of how this actually works in the real world?
So to boil it down very simply, and it can become much more complex than this, but when, for instance, I'm working in the community with somebody who's having difficulty with medication management, if that's for some reason I received a referral to work on medication management with an individual.
That's like all my patients.
It's a very common issue. And sometimes the breakdown is just that the person's forgetting to do it. So let's assume that this person actually is interested in medication management because that's another issue altogether. But the person's forgetting to do their medication management. A simple intervention that is so basic but actually can have a tremendous effect is just moving where the medication is located, put it beside the person's coffee maker, and that is a visual prompt in of itself for the person to take the medication. So that's really boiling it down, but we do manipulate the environment a lot, put up prompts and structure things in a client-centered way such that the person is much more able to complete what they want to complete.
You have an example of someone with maybe mental illness that you're working with and the sorts of things that make that even more unique or difficult or different?
I think a lot of the challenge we have with some of the folks we work with is motivation. And I think what occupational therapy is good at doing is being so client-centered. And so we spend a lot of time with our clients to really get down at what they want to do and how they want to do it. And that helps us overcome some of this motivation issue because we'll end up always working on something the person's interested in working in, and that makes it a lot easier for us. You know, in many ways, we're lucky that we have this approach because some other professions who don't have that emphasis on focusing on what the person is meaningful to the person and maybe working on something the person doesn't want to work on is a much more difficult task to complete than if somebody's actually fully vested in it.
Help me understand. Not all occupational therapists deal in mental health, though, right? I mean, you're really
Correct.
In a very unique position with respect to the larger field of occupational therapy. Is that accurate or?
So it's a very interesting history. We actually came out of mental health services. That's that our origins
social
are in
work,
mental health.
Right?
Along with social work, that's mm-hmm. correct. But now only 2.6% of our workforce is involved in mental health, which is a terrible tragedy. There's a huge need for it. In other countries, we're much more present in mental health. So for example, assertive community treatment teams, which are commonplace across the world, they're a community-based organization of 10 healthcare providers who provide assertive outreach to individuals with mental illnesses who are well enough to live in the community but need some kind of support. In Canada, for instance, OTs are required to be on every single team. In the United States, it's rare to find an occupational therapist on one of those teams. And that's a problem because many of the teams that I work with recognize that they need an occupational therapist because they recognize that they don't have a skilled therapist on their team that can address living skills, yet the expectations are there for them to address living skills. And so this is a huge need that we're recognizing, and part of my career goal is to gather the evidence to make the case at a policy level to include occupational therapy on these teams.
And you're also in the training program. We are also training the next generation of leaders. Is that fair in terms of trying to improve that 2 to 3%?
Correct. Yes. So I teach all the mental health content at the Division of Occupational Science at Chapel Hill, and I heavily push my students to be interested in this field because the need is tremendous.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Antoine Ballard, professor at the University of North Carolina, about how big impact and tiny changes can have on mental illness and homelessness. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Antoine Ballard, professor in UNC Allied Health Sciences, a Division of Occupational Therapy and Occupational Science. And we're talking about the impacts that tiny changes can make over time. And sometimes those tiny changes actually can be big in terms of the amount of people that you touch. And we were talking in the last segment a little bit about sort of the field of occupational science and occupational therapy and sort of how you got into it and the linkages to mental health. And I think as we begin this segment, I want to talk a little bit about sort of your research in the area of the bridge between occupational therapy and mental health. And tell us some of the things that you've been engaged in.
Thank you, Dr. Hooper. So I have been very fortunate to become a part of UNC's Center for Excellence in Community Mental Health. It's part of the Department of Psychiatry in the School of Medicine. And it has granted me many opportunities to be involved in really innovative programs to address serious mental illness in this country, including housing issues that population has to cope with. So individuals with serious mental illness are overrepresented in homeless populations, and there are many reasons for that, including difficulties maintaining permanent employment and difficulty just with basic living skills in that they can sometimes prevent a person from maintaining a stable housing. So housing is a persistent issue with this population, and one of the initiatives that was started at the Center for Excellence was the tiny home community, and I became involved in that as an occupational therapist in that I was consulted in ensuring that the tiny homes themselves were built in a manner that maximized the functional independence of those who would occupy them. And that's just a fancy way of saying that they brought me in to make sure that the home was livable and adapted to a person's needs.
What is a tiny home?
Well, it is precisely that, a very tiny home, at least by U.S. standards. So it's what is so interesting about these tiny homes is they're very affordable. And someone with serious mental illness who is not unable to have a job is often on some sort of a Social Security disability. And the amount of money they receive per month is very, very, very small, which makes finding affordable housing very difficult because once you pay your rent on this very meager income, then there's very little left for anything else in terms of nourishment and just finding things to do. So it's very important to find affordable housing for these folks. And the Center for Excellence has a large farm on which we were able to build a tiny home, which was a pilot. And we conducted focus groups and interviews with service providers and service users to get their input on how the tiny home may or may not be conducive to promoting functional independence. And so we've done all that data collection. We're actually analyzing the data right now, and we'll be publishing it soon. But the primary focus of that first pilot study was to gather enough information to then develop a community that would then be able to host approximately 15 individuals. And we wanted this to be a model program to then disseminate across the nation as a potential alternative for housing for adults with serious mental illness.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I love this idea of small things, even though a house is not small, even a tiny house, but has such a large impact of homelessness on health. I've been fortunate to work with some mental health community in local Durham, not far from here, working on homelessness among teens who may not be homeless in the way we think of it. They're maybe living with a friend, but they're no longer welcome in their home, maybe because they're gay or lesbian, maybe because they were using drugs. Who knows what and how, but what I was struck by, in addition to the housing, was the central role that the skills, and the name of the group is Life Skills Foundation. We actually had the executive director on our show a year or two ago. But the skills that they need to develop. Talk to us just for a moment. You alluded to it earlier. What are the skills that someone who's homeless might need to be able to successfully live in that home?
That's a really good question. And so I'm going to back it up a tiny little bit and just broaden that question actually to just adults with serious mental illness in general. And, you know, the second you receive a diagnosis and you're put on an alternative trajectory compared to your peers, you don't necessarily get all the experiences that your peers would get in terms of developing life skills, particularly if you begin to end up in institutions, if you're hospitalized, for instance, and then perhaps upon discharge, you need to be housed in some kind of supportive housing where you're not entirely responsible for everything and maintaining that housing, including cooking and doing laundry. And so a lot of these folks actually never have the opportunity to develop the skills that are required for independent living. So it's not that they're losing the skills, they just never learned them. So if for the folks who actually end up being homeless, this is even further compounded by the fact that they're not even experiencing opportunities to develop those skills after having already missed the milestones of getting them in the first place. And so there's a lot of work to be done there to give people the simple tools that we take for granted and we think are very simple but are actually much more complicated and that we've learned over time.
Like?
Basic things like learning how to use a microwave can actually be a challenge for some folks. Basic skills around the kitchen are actually very difficult for people to learn if they haven't been trained in a way that we typically are trained, which is just cooking with family, for instance. Other examples are in money management. You know, if you've never had to manage an account or had a credit card and know the consequences of using a credit card, for instance, that a lot of these types of things can position you in a way that you will make poor decisions in money management. And so it's just this cycle that once you end up in this situation of homelessness, that it's really hard to get out of it without learning the skills that can put you in stable housing.
Do you find, as an occupational scientist, that there are several skills that you bring to the table, given our earlier discussion, that would facilitate an individual who's homeless to become successful in their adaptation to living in a tiny home or any other residence?
Absolutely. So again, what I really enjoy about occupational therapy is the fact that we spend a considerable amount of time learning about how the human body functions. So that's more similar to most medical training. You know, we have the classic classes in anatomy, physiology, and movement science, and so on. But then we also spend a tremendous amount of time understanding environmental context. And we look at how basically the physical, social, and cultural environment can impact a person's ability to function. And we take all of that with our understanding of how just to do things. We put all that together and we can do a pretty sophisticated analysis of what a person needs to be able to function.
You're a researcher and I've got to ask you about one of your research projects.
Sure.
A couple of your titles are not ones that I expected to see in an occupational therapist. One starts out with occupational justice and everyday occupational therapy. And the other is Constructing Undesirables, a discourse analysis of othering within an Immigration Systems Act. Okay. Bring this together. Tell us what gives. I love it.
So those articles are more representative of the type of research that's occurring in occupational science. And so occupational science emerged out of occupational therapy as a separate discipline that doesn't only focus on health and focuses on human doing, but different than anthropology in the fact that, you know, anthropology tends to focus more on culture. And I'm sure there are plenty of anthropologists who will be very upset at that gross overgeneralization of the discipline. But
please write to him, not us.
But Dr. Bowyard.
But we actually have a lot of synergy with that discipline, and we share a lot of work. And so my work with immigration has been looking at when people immigrate here, how does their doing change in response to the environment? And the occupational justice stuff has to deal with the idea that people should have the opportunity to be and do what they have value or want to do in their lives, and that there are many forces that exist that prevent people from being and doing what they have reason to value. So the occupational justice approach really focuses on how do we enhance people's capabilities to maximize their potential outside of the healthcare setting.
So with the immigration aspect, because it's such an important issue facing our country, is this about as immigrants come here, how do they do? What are the changes that allows them to function independently, to get the job, to have an account, to do all the things that we take for granted? Even a homeless person might even have in some respects easier time if they came from this culture than someone who's an immigrant? I'm just don't know, but I'm asking.
Absolutely. So you're referring a lot to cultural capital, and it's just really the knowledge of how do you function within a culture. And we absolutely take that for granted, because when you grow up in one particular culture, you're steeped in that for your entire life, and you just don't realize how much you've learned through that process. So, you know, it behooves us to help immigrants learn that cultural capital so that they can contribute to the society and make us all better.
Adam, sounds like we need to have the perspective of occupational therapy and occupational science in our work.
And I didn't even know what I was doing until you told me.
There we go.
But we're really appreciative of you coming on our show. I understand you got a promotion recently from assistant to associate professor. Congratulations. I think it's well earned. Matter of fact, you might even want to ask your boss for a pay raise. I don't know.
Thank you very much. We'll leave that conversation for another time.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to have a short break. But coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. We'll be right back. Thank you so much.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Steve and I are going to spend some time talking about your health questions and concerns. And our executive producer, Laura Lacey, is going to read some of these questions. But if any listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Laura, what's our very first house call today?
Our first listener writes in and asks, my teenage son was in a car accident and was in intensive care for 3 weeks. He has not woken up, though he is moving his extremities. Everyone keeps talking about traumatic brain injury. Is he ever going to wake up, and is he ever going to be the same?
Boy, this is so hard, and I unfortunately have been involved in kind of advising some families that have had this really life-changing series of events, and it's not easy.
It is not, and I think that at this point, as you and I have talked on previous cases, this is sort of the worrisome crystal ball question. You know, what will happen as he moves through recovery?
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's clear is this is where a team approach is critical, and the team has to be team your son. You know, that has to be their focus, and the family, team your son, and the parents, and the siblings, because nothing else can really matter. Insurance can't be the big driving factor here. They just have to recognize that how much support is needed. It could be probably a neurosurgeon, a neurologist, a psychiatrist, a social worker, a physical therapist, and
a neuropsychologist.
And an occupational therapist.
And perhaps an occupational therapist.
So all of these groups need to come together, probably a minister or someone of faith. In my experience, one of the most important things is to know, what are the questions you need to ask? And I start with, like, well, if this were my child, what would I want to know?
Right. I would want to know exactly what the team is thinking about what is happening in the moment. How do we address the current status now? What can I do to be supportive as a parent? And I also would want to dive into the crystal ball a little bit. I think as a parent, you do worry about all the things that this listener has asked about. So for me, I would be curious to know, what do they see as a pathway for recovery in their experience, recognizing that my child's injury may be unique to my child?
Yeah, I think that the first week, what should we be looking for? The second week, the third week, I had a parent recently say they could see things, but the team said they couldn't see things. So there's a little disconnect. There's some conflict between the social worker who perhaps was trying to move the family out before the family thought that they were ready, and now there's conflict. And so I think you have to be able to communicate on a regular basis. That takes time. And I think having someone there to help advocate, to listen, and to kind of negotiate some of those questions would be helpful.
Absolutely. And I also would say, to add to that, knowledge is power. And one of the things that we know from the literature in traumatic brain injury is that a typical recovery curve is about 2 years. And there are studies that take it out, depending on the study, 5, 6, maybe 9 years. And so the fact of the matter is that there is recovery that will occur. The question is how far will that recovery go? But it's a time issue right now, and you're in the very early stages where potential traumatic brain injury really is traumatic, not just for your son, but for your family at this point.
Yeah, good point. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've historically had a hard time staying organized, and I often get distracted. I was reading something the other day that made me question if I have ADHD. I honestly had never thought about that before. But I'm 31 years old. Is it worth it to get a diagnosis at this point?
Let's define ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And we're talking about adult now because you're 31. And this question is, well, we know that children, it's very, very frequent. One of the things I didn't realize so much because it wasn't emphasized in my training, but when I got out in practice, I started seeing a lot of this among adults, some of which who had had it as kids, never treated, but a lot of them who developed it when they were adults.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation because one of the things you wonder about is if you're smart and capable, it can cover up a multitude of sins. And so until those attention challenges are present, you may not actually see them because you have enough skills in your toolbox to sort of get by in the day-to-day. And a lot of times where I've seen it manifest in an adult is not that it surfaces as a new symptom, but there's changes in the ecology or your job or demands where all of a sudden the routines that you've had are not working like they used to, and the attention and this disorganization will then surface.
This adult attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, it's really characterized by inattention, impulsivity, and restlessness, which results in functional impairments. And so I can imagine that there is a team approach to this. There are the medications one wants to use, behavioral approaches, even kind of lifestyle approaches like exercise. Lots of things to work on.
Absolutely. And I do believe that getting diagnosed even as an adult can be very helpful in your life plan forward with respect to not only your job and the things you do for leisure, but also perhaps in your relationships and your family life in terms of how to make things better.
Laura, what's your very next house call?
My wife and I are separating, and we don't know how to talk to our 6-year-old son about the changes that are about to happen. Our separation is decently amicable, and we do want to make this as easy as possible for our son. Do you have any advice for helping him through this?
Well, first off, I should state I've not been divorced, and sometimes one's personal experience can inform, for better or for worse, one's knowledge of that. I also know that it's can be and often is difficult.
Absolutely difficult. The disruption to a family unit also can affect your children pretty significantly, and it is important, according to the literature, a couple of things that I might add. First of all, communication is utmost. People need to be clear and effective in their communication with their children. Number two, the literature does suggest that if the parents, and I heard, Laura, you say that it was amicable, and if in fact they're having amicable separation, the fact is children respond to that. If it's a difficult situation and there's a lot of fighting and argument, kids react to that. But the parents create that stable environment even with this difficult change. When that happens, the transition can be a lot smoother for children even in this difficult environment.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. If you're working together, probably everything will go pretty well.
The other strategy I might suggest is if indeed there needs to be help with that communication or structuring that communication or the message, perhaps a counselor or a therapist could be very helpful to the family involving the child in terms of the whole process so as to keep the communication open and active.
Good point. Laura, what's our very last house call?
Last year, I fell on my shoulder while snowboarding. It had been pretty manageable, sometimes not even noticeable, until I recently moved. The process of moving seemed to aggravate whatever's going on, and the pain has come back more prominently. Other than ice and ibuprofen, what should I do? Should I see my doctor?
It reminds me of the old Bob Newhart show where he says, just don't do that.
Stop it. Stop it.
And he got paid for that advice. Just stop it. You know, to me, this sounds like you're going to see the physical therapist, maybe an occupational therapist, but you're also going to maybe need to see someone who really does do work in shoulders. This could easily be a frozen shoulder, what's called adhesive capsulitis, this scar tissue. It comes on after trauma frequently. You start losing your range of motion. It lasts 1 or 2 years. It can be incredibly painful if you don't get treatment.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, we want to thank our listeners today for their house calls. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can send any questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Antoine Valliard. I want to thank our guest co-host, Dr. Steve Hooper. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Stephen Hooper.
We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.